already under fire for his U-turn on plans for local compulsory house building targets that could raise the standards of the country's housing stock. The policy was dropped after pressure from Tory backbench MPs. One in five, 21.5% of excess deaths in England are related to coal homes, with the UK as a whole said to have among the oldest and poorest quality housing stock in Western Europe. Recently published data from the English Housing Survey has highlighted the poor state of the country's private rental sector. In particular, with 23% of private rentals failing to meet the decent homes standard in 2021 to 2022. That compares with just 13% of the owner-occupied homes and 10% of social housing. James Anderson, the founder of the Disability and Elderly Plumbing and Heating Emergency Repair, a community initiative in the northwest of England for those unable to fix their homes, said he regularly came across houses without central heating. The plumbing and heating engineer recently launched a funding appeal for an elderly woman in Houghton, Liverpool, who was relying on a small electric heater to keep her warm. Anderson warned she was unlikely to survive the winter in her dilapidated and freezing terrace home. Irene has had to get used to this, but she shouldn't have to. She nearly cried when we told her we were going to help her out, he said. Matt Copeland, the head of policy at the fuel party charity National Energy Action, said there had been a failure to help the poorest households retrofit their homes, leaving them reliant on expensive and inefficient electric heaters in many cases. Households without central heating are some of the worst affected by the energy crisis and are twice as likely to be fuel poor than households who do have centrally heated homes, he said. They're also significantly more likely to live in the least energy efficient properties. This winter, with prices high and temperatures dropping, those homes will find it prohibitively expensive to stay warm at home. It is imperative that fuel poor households that are off the gas grid are prioritized for any future target support. A government spokesperson said they were currently consulting over the powers of the regulator of social housing to tackle non-decent homes, and that ministers were introducing a decent homes standard for the private rented sector. She added, "It is completely unacceptable that families are having to live in homes without heating, and we are acting to ensure people can stay warm this winter. This includes £1,200 to help pay their bills." The decent homes standard requires all social homes to have an efficient form of heating, such as central heating, and we will also introduce this to privately rented homes. To help those who use heating oil and fuel other than gas to warm their homes, we have increased the alternative fuel payment to £200 and are committed to delivering this to customers as soon as possible.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
This is all they have to survive with for now. A little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. This Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble. This woman says her son has been held in a detention center for months despite having a UN refugee card. With eyes full of tears and a numb voice, she revealed her ordeal.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman, the outskirts of New Delhi.
Tehran has hosted the first disaster management conference titled Strong Iran. The three-day event has brought together different representatives and experts from various organizations which are responsible for managing natural disasters at the time of crisis. The event is aimed at training responsible organizations to have proper response to natural disasters. Meanwhile, Iran's interior minister addressing the event referred to the earthquakes in Iran, Turkey and Syria and said that the country should maintain its readiness more than ever before.
These events are a warning that we must maintain our preparation more than ever in the past, and dealing with natural disasters requires a modern and not a traditional approach, and the dimensions of these events must be controlled with the help of managerial, human, software and equipment skills.
Iran has been a very disaster-prone country throughout its history. Earthquakes, floods, droughts, inversion effects of air pollution in metropolitans have occurred many times, affected millions of people, and have claimed hundreds of thousands of lives during the past century. According to the World Risk Report, Iran is among the countries with high vulnerability in the world. More than 80,000 people have died during the past 30 years in Iran, directly by natural disasters.
The main objective of crisis management is to identify and prioritize crisis threats to formulate the best strategy for confronting the most immediate ones. Accordingly, holding such an event provides a good opportunity for officials and people to be prepared at the time of crisis. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Lives have been saved in Turkey following recent earthquakes because the country had access to heavy lifting machinery. Experts say many lives were lost in Syria because sanctions prevented the country from having similar equipment. The catastrophe has just been debated in the European Parliament.
Following the disaster, I contacted one of the largest aid agencies in Syria. I've spoken to Italian agencies and other NGOs. They all told me that the EU sanctions present an obstacle to humanitarian work.
European Commission officials told legislators that just 9 of the EU's 27 member states have supplied Syria with support. 21 have scrambled to help Turkey.
The Commission also allocated an additional 3.5 million euros in emergency humanitarian funding to help our partners address urgent needs in Syria.
This 3.5 million euro for Syrians pales into insignificance when compared to the 67 billion euro spent by the EU on Ukraine during the past 11 months. Experts have been saying for years that the bloc lacks unity when it comes to Syria.
Countries are acting in their own way. There is no coordinated action. And this is one of the reasons that we're faced with this very big crisis, this mega crisis.
Efforts by Western nations to overthrow President Bashar al-Assad have failed. Critics say interventionism has brought misery to millions of innocent people in the country. Some lawmakers want the pressure to be paused.
In Syria, there are sanctions. We don't want to see more people die in the cold. They don't have medicines. We must put politics aside and human life first.
It's been announced the EU will host a donors summit next month to gather money for the earthquake-hit regions. Political commentators are claiming it's already obvious that the vast majority of the money raised will go to Turkey, not Syria. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of bed and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country. Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Hundreds of people attended a national conference in Gaza, which was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The event aims to bolster the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, extremist Israeli settlers and political figures, backed by regime forces, have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in Al-Quds. Israeli forces have also killed and injured dozens of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of 2023. Speaking to Press TV, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said the resistance in Gaza is ready to support the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We will not leave the resistance in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank alone, and we will back them with all the necessary means. The occupying regime will not be able to divide the Palestinian resistance arenas. Last night, we witnessed unity in Gaza, Nablus, and Al-Quds.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces more than 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom.
Actually, Al-Quds is not just a word. It's something apart from our heart. So this conference asking and telling the world that this Israeli action against Al-Quds and West Bank must be stopped.
Palestinian resistance factions have expressed their unwavering support for Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. They also vowed to use all forms of resistance to liberate Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank.
We believe that the Israeli government, under the leading of Netanyahu and Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, going to raising up the aggressive against our people in West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza also, maybe in other outside countries also. So we are going to resent the occupation by all kind of resistance.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and the occupied West Bank, while turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Palestinians say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
On Saturday, protests were held in front of the Italian state broadcaster Rai's premises in a number of cities, including Rome, Milan and Naples. The protests had been called against the Rai's decision to read out a message by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky during the final night of Italy's biggest entertainment TV show of the year, a song contest, which brings millions of viewers together.
Noi oggi siamo.
We are here today to remind our politicians the suffering we had to go through for decades after World War II. This man in the photo is my grandfather. He died during that war. We are against the bellicose propaganda broadcast on state TV.
Earlier this week, state broadcaster Rai opted to withdraw a planned video address by Zelensky at the popular TV show and replace it with the reading of a message sent by the Ukrainian leader.
I would have preferred Zelensky to have been present at the TV show. I've appreciated his decision to send a written message and, above all, I'm sorry about the controversy that was stirred up.
We say no to the politicization of culture, no to Zelensky on our TV shows, no to a man who is leading his country to destruction for a war that had been planned for years by the U.S.
The move by Rai to host Zelensky has inflamed the debate on the war in Ukraine in Italy, a country where support for Kiev is more divided than elsewhere in Europe. Since the start of the conflict, surveys in Italy have showed that more than half of the Italians are against supplying Kiev with more weapons.
Many accuse Rai of providing information which is not impartial because the National Broadcaster's Board of Directors is directly linked to the government and the parliamentary majority. As a matter of fact, following a 2015 reform, 6 out of 7 Rai board directors are elected by the 2 houses of parliament and the government.
Italy's state broadcaster is now more than ever in the hands of the politicians. Rai and the government want Zelensky to appear on the television of millions of Italians to make them believe that this Ukraine war is a good war and that sending weapons to Kiev is a good thing.
Italy's Prime Minister Meloni has repeatedly said that supporting Ukraine is the best way to reach a possible negotiated settlement with Moscow and that Rome aims to be a lead player in that regard and in Ukraine's reconstruction. Max Civili, Rome.
The National Media Association in Lebanon held a gathering in the capital, Beirut, to show solidarity with the Syrian people
who continue to suffer because of the U.S. sanctions imposed under the so-called CSAR Act. The journalists, media figures, politicians and representatives of the Resistance Front noted that Syria stood with the resistance groups when the world had abandoned Palestine and Lebanon, and that now is the time to stand with Syria.
From Beirut, the National Media Association announces the Beirut Declaration and calls on the Arab and Islamic people and the free people in the world to work on confronting oppression and stopping the wars of sanctions and famine, which are against basic human rights.
The U.S. State Department has claimed that the sanctions do not target humanitarian aid, but Monday's earthquake has proven the opposite.
It's a mere maneuver by the United States just to confront this wave of indictment to the United States, and it's a way for them to reimpose the sanctions in order to achieve their geopolitical agenda. I believe that we need to keep pressuring the United States, exerting pressure, moral and material pressure, in order to lift the sanctions of Syria.
Over 3,000 people have so far died as a result of the catastrophic earthquake in Syria, as rescue teams continue to search for survivors under the rubble of the buildings, which have been completely leveled to the ground. In addition to rescue efforts, the Syrian people are in dire need of essentials like medicine and fuel, which have not been allowed to enter Syria because of the Western sanctions.
They cannot still, like, turn around sending humanitarian aids to Syria through NGOs or others. It should be through the governments of Syria. After all, the government is doing all the necessary job to help people and to take them to hospitals or to make shelters or so.
On February 6th, the 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck Turkey and Syria, killing thousands in the two countries. While countries like Iran and Russia have sent aid to Syria, the amount of humanitarian assistance that reached the Arab country is still very little compared to the international aid sent to Turkey.
At least five rescue teams from Lebanon headed directly to Syria to provide all the assistance they can of the rescue efforts, yet many are saying the aid that many are providing is not enough. Participants here today stressed that the U.S. and its Western allies need to lift the unjust sanctions against Syria and the Syrian people. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Ibrahim Raisi is in Beijing for a three-day state visit. That's the first such trip by an Iranian president to China in 20 years. Upon his arrival, he was welcomed by his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping. During their meeting, the two presidents sounded determined to strengthen the two countries' partnership, both vowing to work toward implementation of the 25-year Strategic Cooperation Pact, whatever international conditions be.
We believe that implementing the 25-year cooperation agreement and realizing what agreed between the two countries' officials today to develop bilateral ties can promote regional and global peace and stability. Certainly, relations between Iran and China will not be affected by international developments, since we're determined to develop ties with China in any circumstances.
China will continue to be committed to consolidating and deepening relations with Iran. I'm willing to work with President Raisi to enhance strategic communication and promote the steady and sustained growth of the comprehensive strategic partnership between the two countries.
Of course, the two presidents had much more to say. Raisi said there is still much more for expanding economic and trade collaboration between the two sides, adding that such collaboration would contribute to peace and stability across the globe. On the other side, Xi hailed China's growing solidarity with Tehran, saying the two countries have supported each other in the face of complex global challenges. He added that China supports Iran's efforts to safeguard its national sovereignty and independence and counter hegemony and unilateralism. Political analyst Christopher Hilali says further deepening of Iran-China ties will greatly strengthen the developments of a multipolar world.
The deepening of ties further strengthens the development of a multipolar world against what both the Chinese and the Iranians said was the ongoing hegemony and unilateralism of Western domination, specifically led by the United States.
Iranian academic Said Mohammad Marandi, who is accompanying the Iranian delegation in Beijing, says the West antagonistic attitude has accelerated convergence among Asian nations.
Asia alone, through this natural convergence, which is being pushed forward even faster, largely due to the fact that the United States and the Europeans are constantly antagonizing governments and sanctioning governments, whether it's Russia, whether it's Iran, and increasingly China, and also by constantly trying to prevent India from establishing greater ties with these Asian powers. The United States and Europeans are pushing these countries towards greater convergence at a faster pace.
Tehran-Beijing cooperation has been only growing over the past couple of years. China has now become Iran's largest trading partner, with figures showing volume of trade between the two rose by over 40% in the previous Iranian calendar year, which ended on March the 20th. Moreover, Iran is joining the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, a key regional bloc where China is a co-founder. Iran is also eager to contribute to China's mega project, the Belt and Road Initiative. China and Iran now appear set to take their partnership to the next level for prosperity of their nations.
Congratulations to everyone on the occasion of 27th of Rajab, the Feast of Mab'ath, which marks the formal appointment of Prophet Muhammad by God for guidance of mankind. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all Muslims throughout the world on this auspicious occasion.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
News in the Ukraine war is not so much about advancements on the ground as they are about military assistance to Ukraine and Zelensky's guest appearances, like his most recent visit to the UK, then the Elysee Palace in France, and then the EU capital in Brussels, all in a span of a few days. His request, more aid and military equipment, in particular fighter jets. No surprise there. Will he get it? How much aid does he want? How many more requests, and how much longer will Russia tolerate the pumping of military equipment to Ukraine, while all leaders of the Western world have said, we are with you, Ukraine, till the end? First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Andriy Dobryansky, chair of the UN Affairs, the Ukrainian World Congress, joins us from New York. Also joining us, Harley Schlanger, who's at the Schiller Institute in Germany, who joins us from Potsdam, Germany. Welcome to you both. Harley Schlanger, if I may start with you first. We're taking a look at the appearances that Zelensky has made in a span of days, as I said in the intro. looking at the UK and he addressing the parliament there, then moving on to the Elysee Palace. The French president and the German chancellor were there, and of course the EU. Why do you think Zelensky has to make these appearances in the first place? I must add in the Oscars, Wall Street Bells when they open up, and other appearances where he has been appearing via live video stream, which in this case he didn't do in the past three appearances. What do you make of these appearances in the way that he has made them?
Well, I think he's in trouble. He's in trouble in Ukraine. He's shuffling his government. The corruption charges are starting to have some real traction. And their military has been badly damaged by the war. They're running short of ammunition. They're running short of soldiers. And the Russians are preparing an offensive. So it's not so much about Zelensky as it is NATO. Because the decision to have him come to Britain, I mean, look what he did. He met with King Charles. Boris Johnson was at his elbow every step of the way. He met with Sunak. He addressed the parliament. This is all part of a big show, a show of NATO unity. And what they're trying to do, I think, is to convince President Putin that he should back down. Now, also the discussion of the weapons. You know, there are a number of key American military experts who are saying that the tanks are going to be a while before they get there. They may not be decisive. But what Zelensky went to London, Paris, and Brussels for was fighter jets. And up to this point, the U.S. has said no to fighter jets, the Germans also. However, they've changed because they said no to tanks initially. The reason he wants fighter jets and long-range precision missiles is that he wants to target Crimea. And this is where the situation becomes extremely dangerous, because if the West crosses one more red line, and Putin has said Crimea is Russian territory and that Russia will do everything it needs to defend Russian territory.
Right.
This is pushing the situation to the brink of a much bigger war. So I think they're trying to shore up the sense of support for Ukraine. But it's also, look, there are big demonstrations in Europe now. So the situation is not so good for NATO.
Okay. Andrzej Dobryansky, do you agree with the viewpoints there that Harley Schlanger relate, especially, of course, the Ukraine stance overall?
Of course not. These appearances, as you mentioned, these are state visits. So this is the head of a state coming to several different countries. And then, as you said, in Brussels, meeting with several heads of state together, not only to have discussions. We all see the group picture at the end, but it's about the discussions, talking about how support for Ukraine will go on. And almost everybody unilaterally mentioning that they will continue to support Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. That is the way the rest of the world has seen it, and that is the way that is the only way out for the end of this war, which is Putin withdrawing his forces, not, as you mentioned, having some sort of red line. There are six territories that have been occupied by Putin's armies. There are war crimes happening on those territories every day. There is no need for the rest of the world to be okay with these war crimes. At some point, Mr. Putin and all the officers who are involved in this will be held up in some international tribunal.
All right. I'm no military expert, but this is what I'm going to ask you, and I'm wondering if you can help me out in terms of trying to figure this out. You know, we hear about these military assistance and equipment on a rather consistent and continual basis. So my question is, why not just ask all of the equipment that Ukraine needs in one swoop? Get together with the EU, with the US, with whatever countries, and just ask for it and make it clear as to what you're going to get and what you're not going to get. Because it seems like these are just incrementally being asked and then provided. You know, with the F-35s or with fighter jets at this point, I'm not even sure if anybody has committed to it or not. But it's something that may be committed to, just like with other military assistance where, for example, the tanks, they asked for it, they said no. Germany and the U.S. vehemently, outright rejected that idea, but then they gave in. So why not ask for all of it and for the other countries to make their mind up whether they're going to give it or not?
Well, yes, Ukraine has been asking for equipment. Some of that equipment has been passed along to Ukraine. Some of it hasn't, and then Ukraine keeps asking. So it defeats the logic of your question, saying that Ukraine should just have one list and then it's either yes or no. The question is protecting Ukraine, protecting its sovereignty and its right to its territorial integrity. So Ukraine will keep asking so long as the West is ready to give more. We know that there's a promise from Poland to hand over fighter jets as soon as other countries are okay with that as well. We know the United Kingdom is in the same place already trading fighter pilots. So similar to the other technologies, it's a step-by-step process of international diplomacy, not just demanding things from the rest of the world. These are valid states, okay. Independent states, sovereign states, asking each other for help in this crisis.
Okay. Harley Schlanger, one of the reasons why I asked that question is because as we take a look at the requests that are being made, people are dying from both sides. People are dying in Ukraine. There are soldiers that are dying. There are people who are dying. And, of course, Russian side is also has its death toll increase as this war is dragging on. So is there what are we getting at when it comes to the Ukrainian side asking for it and then the other side? And I'm putting them as a whole, EU, Europe, NATO countries, U.S., and they're not providing the military equipment at this point. I think, based on what they have said, they don't want to have that confrontation head-on with Russia. Is that why they're incrementally providing Ukraine with this equipment?
Well, let me say that I think Mr. Dobryansky is right about one thing. Zelensky has been asking for this from the very beginning. He's been asking for much greater weaponry than has been provided, much more support, much more money. And the reason the West has been holding back is they're very much concerned that this is going to spin out of control. Now, one point I want to make in contrast to what he said, the rest of the world is not against Russia. One of the problems Europe has is with the so-called Global South, which refuses to give the support that's being demanded by Zelensky. Look what happened when Scholz went to Brazil recently. Lula turned him down on ammunition, turned him down on the green policy. Lula said that they want a meetings for peace. Much of the world wants peace. Zelensky doesn't. And this goes back to the whole reason why this thing started. There was an effort to get a peace agreement through Minsk, and the West lied to Russia repeatedly. And what were they doing? Why were they lying?
Right.
To have time to build up their military so they could go to war with Russia.
Can I have that part of your statement addressed to Andriy Dobryansky? Andriy Dobryansky, Zelensky
sure.
Doesn't want peace?
No, Zelensky wants peace for his people, obviously. That requires, by definition, Russia leaving the territory of Ukraine. Unless that happens, repeated war crimes will continue to happen. And these war crimes are part of the reason that the rest of the world has decided to provide more and more equipment, because they cannot stand by as women as old as 82, children as young as 4 are victims to sexual violence.
Okay.
At the same time, let me please address the rest of the world. I believe there are 3 nations from Africa on the UN Security Council, and they are part of the strongest voices condemning Russia's neocolonialism in Ukraine. So I'll make sure that the record stands that, you know, some of the strongest words I've ever heard about condemning this war come from African nations. In the case of Brazil and other South American nations, I personally know that the governor of the São Paulo province and many mayors and local administrators throughout Brazil have made numerous statements in support of the Ukrainian people. So you can't just say that, yes, one nation, in terms of its democratically elected leadership, is making one decision, but you can't say that that represents all Brazilians.
Harley Schlanger,
go ahead. There are diverse
opinions. Let Harley Schlanger respond to you then.
Sure,
Harley
sure,
Schlanger,
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, look, the idea that 3 African nations represent a majority of Africa, much of Africa has refused to condemn the Russians for the invasion. Much of Africa, countries like Indonesia, Algeria, Nigeria, South Africa. I could go through a list, but that's not the point. You want to talk about war crimes. What about what was done against the people in the Donbas for 8 years when there was supposedly a peace process underway? I think this is a fallacy that's being presented here in terms of saying it's all Russia, it's all Russia. The Russians went in to defend people who were Ukrainian, living in the Donbas, who were of Russian descent, defend them from networks that go back and trace their roots to the Nazis in the World War II period. So if you want to talk about war crimes, let's talk about that. But in terms of the rest of the world, You have the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the BRICS. You have the Eurasian Economic Union. Many countries are saying there should be peace.
Okay.
The Pope has called for negotiations. The Ukrainians say no negotiations until Russia leaves. And Putin is saying he's not leaving until there are security guarantees for the Russians who live in eastern Ukraine.
Okay.
So I think you have to look at this in a much different way than Mr. Dobryansky is looking at it.
Mr. Dobryansky, as our guests are addressed to you, let me get your reaction on what Putin said recently. Quote, those seeking to defend Russia on the battlefield apparently do not realize that a modern war with Russia would be entirely different for them. We're not sending our tanks to their borders, yet we have something to respond with, and it would not be limited to armor use only. Everyone must realize that. What do you think about that?
I think Mr. Putin's army has been shown to be a paper tiger in Ukraine. That is quite evident. That is quite evident with the tens of thousands of prisoners they rely on to field their forces on the battlefield. We've seen this as far back as the interventions in Syria as well as Georgia. In Georgia, where a MiG was shot down with a simple man pad. And we also see that Russia is afraid of using its air force, because of the possible damage to it. This is not a world where combat-ready force, clearly, and Ukraine has exposed it. Can I just ask you about the
hypersonic missiles that Russia has?
Yeah, they used them anywhere?
I'm sorry?
Have they used them anywhere?
Well, they've said they have them, and they said that it's, you know, I'm sure you're familiar somewhat with it. I just know that it's faster than
speed. But have they used them anywhere?
They said that they may. I'm just curious, and they may have other things in their arsenal.
And I've described them as a paper tiger. We have seen that roughly one-third of all artillery that they've used, ballistic missiles that they've used, have failed. Another third have not detonated, and a third have found their target.
Okay.
So
Harley Schlanger,
this is the state of Russian technology, military technology, that we're talking about.
Okay, I don't know anything about it, really. Let me have Harley Schlanger perhaps address that. Harley Schlanger, go ahead.
Well, I would disagree with his assessment of the situation. The Russians initially were hoping that they could come into Ukraine and force a negotiated agreement. The Ukrainians have, by Ukrainians, I mean the Zelensky regime, has no wish for an agreement because they're being directed by NATO. Remember, end of March last year, there was a near mediation and a negotiated settlement, and NATO sent Boris Johnson to scuttle it. There have been other efforts made to bring this about. Now, meantime, when you want to talk about the deployment of war crimes, what about the article that just came out yesterday by Seymour Hersh exposing that Biden was the one who ordered the destruction of the Nord Stream pipelines, which is affecting the life of every single person in Europe? Now, what you have to look at is the European governments are holding back because they're weak, because in Paris, in France, 3 million people in the streets last week against the war. Denmark, 60,000. We're going to see growing demonstrations against the war because it's costing a huge amount of money for something
Indeed.
That is not in the interest even of the Western
Sorry countries. To jump in, Harley Schlanger. I saw Andrich shake his head. Go ahead.
I know that those protests that are being mentioned, the numbers obviously inflated, but those aren't necessarily protests solely against helping Ukraine. Those are protests altogether against government involvement in a whole host of things. So that's one thing. But in terms of what Ukraine is doing, Ukraine is not, and you will not see Zelensky at all these appearances, as you mentioned at the beginning, or these state-to-state visits, talking about no negotiation. Since September of last year, President Zelensky has outlined a 10-point peace plan. We would love for the rest of the world to get on board with some of these peace plans, and they don't all need to happen at the same time. I believe President Zelensky is actually willing to talk about all of these one by one, the first of which is that we should remove all military forces from the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. That is a basic tenet of all international law, and everybody should be behind that. So it's simple tenets like these that eventually lead up to his final point, which is a tribunal for all the people who have committed war crimes in Ukraine. But in terms of negotiating, President Zelensky has put out a peace plan out there.
The Ukrainians who killed the civilians in Donbass, should they be brought before military tribunals?
I know that there are some conspiracy theories being propagated, such as whatever blog post, as the U.S. government has mentioned, about Mr. Hirsch's quote-unquote reporting, which is all based on one anonymous source. So in terms of conspiracy theories, there's not that much that I can, you know, really talk about. But
well,
I can talk
about the killing that went on in the Donbas, the killing of civilians in the Donbas that went on for 8 years.
Is this something
that
Roger Waters testified about? Who testified about this at the UN Security Council? Roger Waters?
The people who lived there.
The people who lived there testified
the West,
to
who were being suppressed from talking in the West.
Testified
it's called
to the UN
a conspiracy
Security Council?
Theory.
There is a special rapporteur for war crimes
saying,
in Ukraine.
Are you saying that there haven't been casualties in Donbas inflicted by Ukrainian forces? Are you saying that?
I'm saying that there's a special rapporteur for war crimes.
Will you go on record and say that there are no civilians killed?
I'm telling you that there's a special rapporteur for war crimes in Ukraine. All of that is laid out in public, all the reports. You can read exactly what's happening. But what you're alluding to, again, in these numerous conspiracy theories, trying to tie together some red thread on the wall, is that listening to musicians like Roger Waters, listening to film actors like Steven Seagal are the experts we should be talking to, as opposed to actually going to Ukraine and talking to people, which is what I do on a regular basis.
Well, how about the Ukrainians who are the Russian civilian Ukrainians who have given statements about what they lived through with the shelling of their schools and the killing of their children? I can't believe you're calling that a conspiracy theory.
I don't define people based on their blood or ethnicity, some kind of weird nationalistic thing. There are Ukrainian citizens.
These are people who have...
Okay.
The Bandera supporters inside the military do use racial definitions. And that's one of the reasons they continued to attack the people in the Donbas. And that is not a conspiracy theory. And if you're saying
all right, let's
that,
move on.
I think it is.
Let's move on to something
that... I think if you're talking
about
somebody who died 80 years ago as leading an army, I think that's a conspiracy theory.
Andriy Dobryansky, let's move on to another issue, which is something that even the Ukrainian president has realized was a problem. Can you guess what that is?
No.
Okay. Corruption.
Exactly. Okay, so what's going on with the corruption scandal? 9 top officials... And, of course, the most high-profile one was the defense minister, if I'm not mistaken, and then a cabinet reshuffle. Or a government reshuffle. Do you see that being... Because Ukraine has been described as having a lot of corruption in it. It's been described. I can come up with some sources. First of all, what do you think of that? How far-reaching is the corruption that has come about, based on the aid, at least, just that portion of it?
I think when certain people mention that they can find sources citing Ukraine's corruption, normally that refers to decades-old or years-old information, especially prior to this full-fledged aggression, as well as prior to the revolution in 2014. If you look at international corruption indices, you'll actually see that Ukraine's invader is actually ranked higher on a scale of corruption than Ukraine. That's just a known stated fact. As to what's happening in Ukraine, no, the defense minister hasn't been reshuffled. There was an early report out. Somebody tried to jump the gun and saying, absolutely, he's being moved out. Defense Minister Reznikov has said that's not the case. It's still not the case. And in terms of what happened in Ukraine, it's actually a standard of anti-corruption that most countries would be jealous of. I would be jealous of that here in the United States if there was a scandal that came out in the press. And 3 days later, the scandal being that some prices for eggs bought for the military were high, some prices for wheat were low, and who was making money off of this? Within 4 days, numerous officials in the defense ministry were relieved from their positions and taken under investigation. That is a standard that many Western countries cannot match, nor is that something you would ever see in Russia.
Hardy Schlanger.
That's because you're the recipient of hundreds of billions of dollars from the West. Now, I'll give you a couple of sources that have cited corruption since 2014. The Panama Papers, Transparency International, which is one of the most authoritative institutions looking into corruption, lists Ukraine as the most corrupt country in Europe. Now, you can take that up with them. I'm just saying that what we're looking at is a regime which is going around asking for billions of dollars and was unwilling to provide the normal papers and normal accounting procedures that governments would take. That's why there's a corruption scandal. And Zelensky is going to use this reshuffling, or the alleged reshuffling, to say to his Western partners, look, we're trying to deal with this. Don't hold back the money. We'll take care of it. I think that's not a conspiracy theory. I think you have to look at that quite as a serious problem.
All right. My last question to each of you. First, to you, Andriy Dobryansky. Sure. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has warned that Russia was building up its troops to take revenge because of this one-year anniversary coming up, or one-year, not anniversary, but marking the time when this operation took place. You called Russia a paper tiger. I'm curious as to whether a paper tiger in possession of so many nuclear warheads should be called that.
Oh, absolutely. They've been using the fear-mongering of nuclear warheads for decades. As actually almost as soon as President Putin came to power, he's talked about launching nuclear weapons at Poland, against Turkey, against a whole slate of nations. He's never used them. We don't even know if they work. So, in terms of what's happening, people are actually dying, and those should be addressed before we talk about these figments of Putin's imagination.
All right. Hardik Schlanger, in response to our guest there. Less than a minute, please.
Well, I think what we're going to see is that it's not a paper tiger. If it's such a paper tiger, why do you need $100 billion of American taxpayers' money to send weapons to you? I mean, this is a fraudulent conception you're presenting. No one wants to see war. No one wants to see killing. But the question is, will Zelensky sit down with a clean slate and talk with Putin? This is what Pope Francis has requested. He's offered the Vatican as a venue. And I haven't heard anyone in Ukraine say they're willing to do that yet. The Russians said they would be willing to do that.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. It was a great discussion. Andriy Dobryansky, Chair of UN Affairs, Ukrainian World Congress from New York, thank you. And Hardik Schlanger, thank you. Schiller Institute, Germany, Potsdam, Germany is where he spoke to us from. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tatlay and the team. It's goodbye.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa by a shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet